Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And you know, to do this, I have to make a lot of judgment calls about which entrepreneur to have on Mixergy, which ones not to. And I feel like we do a good job because we spend hours researching guests and, you know, trying to figure out who's right and who's just, you know, talking the talk and getting away with it on other podcasts, and we just don't want them on here. But sometimes I make mistakes. Sachin Reki is apparently one of those people who I made a mistake with in the past. I don't know. He just reminded me before we started that the two of us had conversations in the past and we never had him on here. And I'm not sure why. We're going to find out here in this interview. He has had a string of successful companies. At least it looks like that from the outside. I want to hear from the inside how well they went. He founded a company that was acquired by iMeme, which was then acquired by MySpace. It was one of those early acquisitions that Michael Arrington of TechCrunch covered. He then created a software called Connected, which people loved as the CRM that was then acquired by LinkedIn. He is now currently working on a company called NoteJoy. Let me read that one sentence description of NoteJoy that he gave me. Collaborative notes app for teams. And I'm wondering if that's the best way to describe it. I feel like it's what Evernote wanted to be before the founder left and while the founder was there. And it's doing it right. And I want to know why he wants to get in the space and why he wants to focus on it. This interview is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors. The first will let you get some publicity. So if you're starting out in business, you should really get publicity once your product is right. They'll help you do it. It's called Just Reach Out. And the second will help you hire phenomenal developers. It's called Top Tal. Sachin, good to have you here.
Here.
I feel like you told me about that, that we weren't on, and you touched like a nerve for me, which is that I hate when I don't have the right entrepreneurs on. But nobody ever feels insulted. Nobody ever walks away feeling like, oh, I hate Andrew's a jerk. Who does he think he is? Do you ever feel that way?
Nope, not at all.
Yeah, you seem like a happy-go-lucky person. Are you?
You know, I just took that personality test that's going around from, that website. Apparently I have very little negative emotionality. So I guess I just am a high...
Always? Or is it because you've had this string of successes and you've got like your life organized?
You know, it's definitely gotten better, I'd say. Like, I think, my wife and I talk a lot about this kind of pursuit of self-actualization and where we are in kind of Maslow's hierarchy. And certainly it's gotten a lot better in the last few years because of the string successes, because of matching kind of what we're working on now with our ultimate passion and doing it in a way that is compatible with what we're really excited about.
I had a note here for our producer who talked to you. I said, you spent too much time talking about NoteJoy. What about the past companies that he sold? Spend time on that. So I'm gonna throw away what you and she talked about, but I'm gonna spend a lot of time with you finding out about those previous companies. How much did you sell Connected for to LinkedIn?
It was never disclosed, but I will say it was meaningful.
It was. I thought maybe it was an acquihire.
Yeah, so it ended up being more than an acquihire. They actually ended up, it was a small team. Actually, it was just my co-founder and I when we got acquired. But they ended up using all the technology. So it was amazing. We were a Python shop. We built a bunch of code around contact management and whatnot. And they ended up deciding, even though LinkedIn was classically a Java shop, to build a Python team around me and kind of our team. Okay. And actually integrated the technology quite deeply. We had a bunch of kind of core technology around merging contacts in kind of a way better way than Plaxo was doing at the time. It ended up being meaningful. What happened, which was fortuitous, is that when we got acquired, the LinkedIn stock price was at about 70. And in the 4 years I spent there, I saw it go all the way up to 210.
200K?
210 in terms of stock
210.
Price.
210. Oh, of course.
So the
makes
stock
sense.
Price almost went up like, you know, three times. And so that significantly improved the value of our equity, which, you know, we'll talk about in a bit. But, you know, with iMeme, I had the exact opposite experience where I got all this paper money in terms of equity. And that value ended up going almost to zero.
Because it was, that was an acquihire. I went back and I looked at Michael Arrington's post. It was basically one of these companies in the music space that was supposed to do killer well. And then it basically got smashed by the music industry. And we're going to find out about that. You know, let me go further back even than that. Let's talk about when you were a kid playing Carmen Sandiego. My brother used to play that. What was it that you liked about playing that game as a kid?
You know, it was just this opportunity to kind of fly around the world through this game. You know, you'd learn about kind of the pyramids in Egypt. You learn about kind of all these different places. And it sort of became this like fun way to be forced to learn about it, because that's the only way you can succeed in the game.
So you went to your mom and you said, all right, I want more of these video games. And what did she say?
She said, no, absolutely she said, not. She's like, it's a waste of time, this computer thing. I don't want to support this. This is just, you know, playing time. You should be studying more.
So what did you do because of that?
You know, it was like one of these things where I was just enthralled with this Apple IIc computer that my uncle had given me that I had these games on. And since I couldn't get any new games, I decided, well, maybe there's a way I can make games. And so I found out on this, you know, Apple IIc, it had an Apple basic programming language. And I just started tinkering with that and then realized I could make my own games. And so I started with these like basic text-based adventures. So, you know, it'd be this thing where like my friends would come and play this game and it'd be like, hey, you're in a room. Do you want to go left, right, or straight? And you type straight, and then it'll tell you you were stabbed by a dagger.
I remember those types of games. I wasn't playing them, but they were pretty popular, and you created one yourself.
Yeah.
Using
yeah.
a lot of if-then commands.
Exactly. And go-to statements in the back of the day of Apple Basic.
I think you wanted to be, I heard you wanted to be like Bill Gates, right?
Yeah. And you know, I think it was this revelation that happened to me at kind of the beginning of high school, where I was just making games for absolute fun. And then someone told me you could be paid to be a software engineer. And, you know, I grew up in Rochester, New York, upstate New York, didn't really know any software engineers around there. And I just fell in love with this idea that someone would pay me to like make games or any kind of software. And so that's when I really got passionate about that's what I'm going to do with my life. And, you know, I remember having kind of hearing about Bill Gates, this guy who created Microsoft and sold a bunch of software. And so I was like, okay, well, that sounds like what I want to do. I got to build software and then sell it. And that became kind of my role model.
Gumball was your first software company. You were a kid about how old?
That was at the beginning of high school.
Wow. Okay. And so you started creating software, but you did something that a lot of engineers don't know how to do. You started selling using this creative selling process. Well, what did you do?
Yeah. So, you know, it was one of these things where I was making these different programs, anything from like the games we were talking about. I created this thing for my classmates called Vocabulary Master. So it's this simple app that basically quizzed you on your vocabulary test, let you, you know, come up with the word a couple times. Otherwise, it'll tell you the definition. And so I started to distribute this to friends. And I was like, well, you know, it turns out Bill Gates, like, not only makes the software, but then he sells it. And like, I remember reading about the early days of IBM selling an operating system. So I'm like, I got to figure out how to do that. And so I actually hired my friends to be my sales team. And so I went to a bunch of my friends. I had about five of these guys that were my sales team, and basically told them, hey guys, do you want to sell my software? And they're like, sure. And so I gave them a quota. They each had to sell at least 10 copies of the software, and the software cost 10 bucks each. And I just said, go out to this world and go sell some software.
And they did it. And then at one point, one of them couldn't hit his quota. And out of desperation, they contacted their mom and said, you need to buy it from me.
Yeah. So he ended up selling a bunch of copies to his parents.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. So then from there, you decided to go get a job. You worked for Microsoft for your hero growing up, Bill Gates. And by the way, let me say this. Bill Gates was the richest man in the world for a long time. Before there was even a book about him, for the longest time, people did not have any respect for entrepreneurs. They just did not care. Who even remembers the billionaire who was the richest man in the world before him? I do, because I was a kid reading about this stuff. John Kluge. I don't think there was a single book about John Kluge. John Kluge was fantastic. He was this guy, and like fantastic story. He was this guy who owned a bunch of local television stations, and he became the richest man when Rupert Murdoch came to him and said, I need to create Fox Broadcasting Company. I'm going to buy your stations, because then I could convert them to Fox stations. And then because I have a few stations that are running my network, I could then go out and get others. And he built Fox News, and John Kluge became this billionaire. Before that, he was like a poker player in college. It's like all these stories were fascinating. Nobody cared. You're one of the few people who cared. You ended up working for Microsoft. I'm curious about what led you to start, I guess it was called anywhere.fm, anywhere. Mm-hmm. What was it that led you to start that, your first big startup?
You know, I'd say that story is kind of crazy. What ended up happening was I had a really good buddy at Microsoft, Anson, that him and I used to do dinners monthly where we talk about different startup ideas. And we both knew that we treated Microsoft as really our grad school with the idea that we both wanted to start something eventually. He was working on Xbox, which is one of the coolest divisions, but frankly, he got bored pretty quickly. And about a year into both of our stints at Microsoft, he's like, you know, I'm getting kind of antsy. Maybe we should go start something. And I was like telling him, man, I just got to Microsoft. Things are going really well. Let's hold off. You know, maybe 6 months from now, we can go look at it. And eventually he comes back and he said, Sachin, I'm going. I'm starting something. Are you coming or not? And some of the early advice I got from friends was that when you find someone that you're passionate about working with, that you know you're compatible with, that's eager to start a company, those opportunities are rare. And you might kind of want to run with those. And actually, it turns out in Seattle, it's one of these tough places where especially getting a job out of Microsoft out of college, you're making good money, especially against the cost of living, that everyone starts buying real estate and getting a condo and whatnot, that the number of people that actually go and start something starts to diminish very quickly. And so here was Anson, who was really excited about starting something. And so ultimately, I decided, all right, I'm going with you, Anson. Like, I don't know when I'm going to find the next great co-founder to work with. And we did. And the shocking thing was at the time, we didn't really have a startup idea. We just knew we wanted to start a company.
And you were just going to experiment with ideas. What are some of the ideas that you tried out?
Yeah, so we decided we were going to experiment with a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I think we very quickly hit on the idea of Anywhere.fm. Actually, after we'd come up with this other kind of idea, which was sort of this like, you know, hey, maybe we can create this sticky notes for the web kind of interface. You know, and you can see I've come back to that idea in many ways with NoteJoy. But at the time, we had this idea of like, maybe it's easier to capture these quick notes in a lighter weight interface on the web.
And so— Wait, oh, so it wasn't going to be sticky notes on other people's sites. It was going to be a site where you could just leave your notes.
Exactly. So okay. You go
By the
there.
Way, is this before you got into Y Combinator? You were in, was it the first batch of Y Combinator in Boston?
Yeah, the third actually.
The third. Yeah. So they did three in Boston. So this was before Y Combinator that you came up with the idea for Anywhere, or was it after?
Yeah, so we came up with the idea for sticky notes. We then got an opportunity to interview with Paul Graham for Y Combinator. And Paul Graham was, I hate your idea, but you know what? I really like the three of you. We ended up pulling our third friend from Amazon. And he's like, you guys are in, but you got to come up with a brand new startup idea.
Why did he hate it? You were not the first person to tell me that. Alexis Ohanian said the same thing, that he had this idea for ordering food on a phone before there were smartphones. And Paul Graham didn't like the idea at all. Neither did Jess. I don't think Jessica had a strong opinion, but they did both like them strongly.
Yeah.
What was it about you that they liked? And what was it about your idea that they didn't like?
You know, I think what they didn't like was just at the time, they just didn't think the market opportunity was that big.
For notes.
Okay. You know, that was kind of Paul's specific take on it. But what he saw in us as the team was just kind of three folks that were, you know, we'd always been talking about startup ideas, that we were super passionate about this. We quit our jobs to go work on this full time, regardless of whether we were going to get YC funding or not. We were committed to it. We just thought, you know, hey, if we can get into YC, that would be even better. So I think he loved our commitment and energy, specifically around like really, really needing to do a startup. And, you know, at the time with YC, you know, YC was one of these things that a lot of people were very skeptical of the model. They were kind of thinking of it as like this idea lab trying to be recreated as a startup incubator.
An idea lab was this accelerator incubator thing that failed miserably in the first version of the internet. So this was a second attempt at it. And then the other thing that people were skeptical about Y Combinator for a long time was they were just going to create these little businesses that were just novelty items online, right? Like no one thought that Reddit would amount to anything. Even when they sold, it didn't set the world on fire. And so it felt like they were just going to... So what was it that you liked about them?
You know, it was our first venture into getting into a startup, and we were looking for any help or any resources we could. Okay. And, you know, we heard about Paul Graham and what he was doing, and, you know, we ended up meeting Alexis Ohanian and Steve Huffman and the guys before us. And we're like, wow, like if we can have any support and help to figure this out, as opposed to doing it on our own, we'd love it. And especially when we ended up moving from Seattle to the Valley, the network that we got from Y Combinator was just amazing.
Okay, I see an article that you wrote a long time ago about your Y Combinator experience where you said, We started out as a anywhere.fm became a web-based music player, kind of like iTunes, well, back when iTunes made sense. Now it does way too much, but on the web. And so you were going to let people play MP3s?
Yeah, and actually allow them to take their entire MP3 collection, upload it to the web, and then play it from anywhere.
Why did they like that? Because the world of people trying to let you upload MP3s to the web was full of failed companies that got destroyed, right? Like MP3.com got knocked on their head. I interviewed the founder a long time ago. What was it that they liked about that idea?
So what was fascinating about it was when we built the sticky notes technology, we actually used Flash and Flex as actually our code base. And what was fascinating about it is one of our co-founders, Lux, was just playing around and he created this little music player in the sticky note interface. And actually that's when Paul was like, hey, I really like this music thing. What if that thing was the entire thing? And what was exciting about it was at the time, using Flash technology allowed you to create very rich, sexy experiences. And our player ended up being super sexy. Not only did we have all the features you'd expect in iTunes, but we recreated Winamp style visualizers, but in your web browser.
And these are those little the things that just make the music feel like it's moving on your screen. Okay. Exactly. And so you had all that. You launched it. You then got customers. How?
You know, like first we just got press, folks like TechCrunch got us press and then got a bunch of users through that. We also just used the YC network. Obviously, like all of our early customers and users were just people from the YC class. One of our best growth hacks actually ended up being StumbleUpon.
How did you stumble upon? This was a site where you just keep hitting another button and see another random site that kind of was geared to your liking. Then again, hit a button and get another one. What did you do that made that work well?
So what was awesome was someone like a bunch of people started stumbling us. And then, you know, you can basically give StumbleUpon feedback that you actually liked it. And then we started seeing a bunch of organic traffic from StumbleUpon. So we started optimizing the experience. Initially when you come to anywhere.fm, you have to log in, create a sign up. We actually changed it. So as soon as you come to anywhere.fm, we can just start playing music. We grabbed a ton of indie music and we actually started, as soon as you hit the site, the music just starts playing.
Ah, okay. And people like that quickness at a world where you couldn't get music online very easily.
Yeah.
This is before YouTube Music.
Exactly. And then as soon as they opened up their ad platform, we actually became one of the first platforms where you can pay for stumbles, where you can actually pay for people to come. And it was cheaper than any other ad platform at the time because no one really understood StumbleUpon and why you would pay for it.
Why'd you sell to iMeme?
So, you know, it was one of these fascinating challenges being in the music space. It was one of these situations where we allowed you to take your entire music collection, upload it to the web and play it from anywhere. We also let you have your friends play that music. And so the way we did that is we converted your iTunes playlist into radio stations that your friends could play, kind of like what Pandora does. And we made them legally compliant radio stations. However, the legal challenge we had was the same challenge that MP3.com and some of the other digital lockout services had, which is if you and I upload the exact same song, I have to keep both copies on my site, even though they're the exact same bits on disk. Makes it cost prohibitive to really run a digital locker service.
Yeah, that was a nutty thing. Let me just emphasize that. If I have a song on my computer and you have the exact same one on your computer, we both had the CD because we both went old school and bought it. We both then uploaded to a service. That service can't say, this is the same file. I'm just going to keep it once and play it for both people. No, it has to say, I'm going to have one for Sachin, one for Andrew. Okay, and so it was starting to get expensive for you to run the site. Let me pause here for a second and then come back and continue telling your story. Actually, you know what? Let's continue with the story and then we'll come back to the ad. So you said this is too expensive. Why was partnering up with iMeme such a helpful thing?
Yeah. And so then the cost was becoming fairly prohibitive. We had raised $20K from YC at the time. We raised another $100K afterwards from YC, Paul B. Kite, and a few other people. But our Amazon S3 bills were skyrocketing. And actually at the time, we were Amazon S3's second largest customer after SmugMug because of the terabytes of music that people have uploaded. And so we were going down the route of potentially raising funding and actually got in touch with Sequoia. And Sequoia had spent a bunch of time with us, especially because of the YC connection. But ultimately, what they wanted to do was introduce us to iMeme. And the rationale was, hey, iMeme has actually done deals with all four major labels. So all of your legal questions and cost issues go away because they have on-demand streaming rights. Mm-hmm. And so then you don't have to worry about any of the costs. And what we were starting to realize was that to create a digital locker service and really make it work, we'd have to have people paying us like $10 a month for this service when we really had thought of it as this kind of freemium style model. We didn't think we could make the economics work independently as a freemium digital style business. So when we saw the opportunity to get acquired by iMeme and really leverage their licenses to not have to worry about the cost piece of it, we saw that as an opportunity.
And iMeme at the time let people play their music, but also embed those music, those songs on the number one social network, MySpace.
That's right. Exactly.
That's what it was. They raised what, $20 million, $50 million from Sequoia. Wow. They had a bunch of money.
Quite a bit. And
no wonder.
It was one of these things where, unfortunately, all of that money, more than 50%, went straight back to the labels in terms of licensing fees.
All the like $50 million you're saying went to the labels?
Yeah. About 50% of it. Because the licensing fees to get these great deals, they had deals with all four major labels for on-demand streaming, which was rare at the time. And so they were actually the largest ad-supported music streaming site in the world. They had over 30 million monthly uniques. But it came at a cost. These licenses were not cheap.
And then after the acquisition, the company basically shut down. Why did MySpace even want to acquire you guys?
Well, so MySpace or iMeme?
I guess iMeme, I could understand why they'd want you. You guys are in the same space. You guys actually have a different twist on it. It's related. Why did MySpace want to acquire the combination of the two companies?
Yeah, it was mainly to get access to the audience. Because iMeme had built up this user base of 30 million users, they basically wanted to redirect it to the new service that they were building, MySpace Music. And it turned out, because the licensing deals that MySpace Music had was different than iMeme, there wasn't a clear just, hey, let's keep both running, but let's take advantage of the audience so we can have it.
Oh, that's awful. That's so bad. And then they closed down. Did you feel like a failure at the end of that?
You know, it was tough. I'd say like when we first Anywhere.fm got acquired by iMeme, you know, we were paper millionaires, each of the three co-founders. And we saw all of that with the MySpace acquisition, basically have that paper wealth go to zero.
And when it did, how did you handle it?
You know, it was tough. I think I had seen the path coming for iMeme to not really been able to monetize. It was fascinating. I spent my time at iMeme the first year working on the user experience, which was kind of what they brought us in for because our player was so sexy and they wanted us to bring that UX to iMeme. But after I got there, I realized monetization was a big issue. So I spent all my time trying to right the ship in terms of monetization, creating a new actually audio ad program. Now we're all used to this with Spotify and whatnot, but this was one of the first audio ad programs. So I was trying to solve for it on the monetization side. Unfortunately, you know, we even created millions of dollars of new revenue, but it was too little too late. And you know, we're forced to sell to MySpace out of that opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it beyond like your ability to solve it technically, there needed to be a group of people who are willing to buy it. And then their companies whose whole job is to take your text and convert it into a good voiceover ad that you can then put into these audio networks. But you didn't tell me that. How did you feel personally? I know I had a situation where I have in my drawer somewhere here an acquisition offer for one of my companies for almost $100 million. I said no to it. And then years later, I was basically sleepwalking through my day thinking, how did you not take that opportunity? You had an opportunity to lock in your wealth. And it was tough. What was it for you?
You know, I think it was an absolute roller coaster ride, like especially when it feels so real, when the paper value is, you know, kind of sitting you in the face. And so it was really tough. I think the saving grace, sadly, is that it was sort of a slow decline. And so I saw it coming. And so there wasn't really any moment where I'm like, oh my God, all of a sudden, like now, you know, iMeme is no more. It was more like, I saw this coming the entire time and I was trying to right the ship. You know, I think the biggest challenges I suffered was, could I have done more to make more monetization happen,
right?
Do it faster? You know, was this partly kind of my fault that, you know, the whole company wasn't able to survive? It's kind of one of the...
How'd you get past that?
You know, I think ultimately it was sort of like a realization that you know, it wasn't about us as much as it was about kind of the industry and the model, and it, we just wasn't ready for it. And it's one of these things where timing is one of these things that you just can't control and plays a big part of it. And just realizing risk is part of being an entrepreneur, and it's part of kind of the ride. And, you know, I think then moving on to go do my next startup, realizing that this is the risk you bear when you go and do something.
All right, we'll come back and talk about that. By the way, Dalton Caldwell, I think it was a talk that he gave, but I think I might have read it as a blog post about the difficulty of getting into the music space. And I feel like he's someone who's super brilliant, who's always right, and the market, unfortunately, doesn't agree with him. Like that. He also did a Twitter killer. There's so many people wanted that thing to work. And he was right to say there needs to be something better. He was right with music to say there needs to be something here that's online. And the market, unfortunately, just slaps his great ideas down. It's one of those really difficult experiences to watch. But I'm impressed that the guy just kept going no matter the difficulty. All right. First, I want to tell you about a company called Just Reach Out. They do PR. Now, the thing is, a lot of businesses, Satya, need good PR, but PR agencies charge, what, $15,000, $20,000 a month, which basically starts to sap a lot of your cash, and then they don't produce much, those PR agencies. So Just Reach Out said, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to keep things simple. And he gave me a bunch of examples. I'll give you one of them, because this guy, Dimitri, just freaking loaded me up with examples of how he does PR for people. But I like one. There's something called RoboKiller, which you could attach to your phone. As we were talking, I got junk calls on my phone. I forgot to turn stuff on. There's something called RoboKiller that you can connect to your phone. Apple even allows this, that will then start to screen out all the junk calls. Now, most people don't understand that this exists, don't know that there's a company out there to do it, and there are tons of apps in the App Store. How does RoboKiller stand out? Well, what they did was they said, you know, we're not going to hire a PR agency. We're just going to work with Just Reach Out, justreachout.io/Mixergy. And what Just Reach Out helped them do was figure out how to explain what they do in a way that people care about. How to talk about the founders like these two contest winners who had this idea that the FTC was sponsoring, how they're helping fight back all these robo-killers, how they have these creative ways of basically taunting the robo-killing companies. Once they get them on a phone, they record these calls and then they play them online. Like all these little cutesy things. I see you smile as you talk about it. That's what robo-killer needed to identify that was interesting about them. Just Reach Out, help them identify those things, help them tell their story, put together a list of media outlets to go after, and then show them what to do. How do you go after those media outlets? And then it was on RoboKiller to actually do the work, to actually go out there and get that publicity. And you know what, Sachin, you probably know this. The founder is more likely to get press than some random PR flack that nobody cares about. And so if the creators knew what to do, they could just go out there and start pitching themselves. I know about this because I interviewed the founder of RoboKiller and I said, how do you get all this press? They said, we just worked with this company, justreachout.io. And sure enough, they were on ABC, they were on national stations, they were local stations, everyone seemed to have covered them. If you need some publicity for your company, and Sachin, that goes for you too, here's what you do. Number one, go to justreachout.io/Mixergy. Number two, you're going to see that Dimitri is a freaking madman behind there who is probably going to want to screen you to make sure you're a good fit. So he's going to ask you to just jump on a call with him or somebody to see if it's a good fit. And if you are, he will help you get a ton of publicity for your company. This guy's a freaking madman. I asked him for help once. He starts working with my writers. He starts working with my team to help us write good content. Not like assistant or someone. He does it. He's probably going to be the person who gets on a call with you. He loaded me up with these freaking ton of case studies. Dimitri, I can't go through a million different case studies. Anyone who wants it can go see it on his website. I'm going to tell you guys, go to justreachout.io/Mixergy. You can book a demo with him. He'll spend time with you. He'll probably over-deliver because the guy's a little bit of a madman. I don't know how he's still in a relationship with his wife, considering how much time he puts into his work. I asked him for one bit of help. It wasn't just that. He even took me to breakfast to spend time telling me how I could do my stuff. All right. Justreachout.io/Mixergy. You're in a relationship, Sachin? You are. You're married.
Yep.
Did you make sure to spend time with your wife?
Yes, every day. Actually, a lot.
Like at night every day? Because you don't have kids.
No kids, yes. We just have a puppy, a four-year-old puppy.
You thinking about how? No, it's too much of a personal question. I'll tell you what, Olivia and I, we have these young kids. It is so tough for us to just go do date night. We will like get into these wacky arguments sometimes. And it feels like, what are we even doing together? And then we go to date night. We go, oh yeah, this is what we like each other a lot. It's like these interruptions in our time. The kids who are screaming, the obligations that cause trouble. All right, let's go on to the next company. You decide, I'm not giving up on entrepreneurship. I still believe in it. You not only created Connected, but dude, I went back in time. You must have been a madman getting publicity. These little bloggers wrote in-depth articles about Connected. What was the idea for Connected?
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting because the idea for Connected actually came from iMeme, which most people are surprised about. How do I go from music to this kind of contact management tool? And so it turned out at iMeme, because I was focused on monetization, especially working with our audio ads, I ended up spending a lot of time with our sales team. So the sales team would literally fly me out to Madison Ave in New York City to go meet with a bunch of these ad agencies. And I'd be kind of the technical guy talking about the ad product. And I got a chance to work with our top salespeople. And what was fascinating to me is the first time I'd actually worked with salespeople. And what was amazing is I realized they're 10Xers just like software engineers. We all talk about this idea that a software engineer can be a 10Xer, meaning a single software engineer could have the output of up to 10 software engineers based on just skill and ability. I found that exactly to be the case with salespeople. And you know what you'd see is you'd have an average salesperson bringing maybe 100K of quota, and then you'd have an amazing salesperson bringing in 1 million of quota in the same month. And I really started to ask myself, why is that? What is so special about these rock stars that I get to work with compared to the average salesperson? And what I realized was that there's many aspects of it, but one of the most important was how intuitively relationship-oriented these folks were. And how, you know, I remember one of the guys I worked with, Matt, you know, we'd fly to New York and we'd be in New York and we had a bunch of meetings scheduled. But that night he'd be flicking through his phone and being like, hey, let's go meet up with Sarah. Let's grab coffee or let's grab a drink with her. I'm like, oh, do we have a meeting with her? It's like, no, we're just building network and kind of building relationships and rapport. We'd go into these sales meetings and, you know, he'd spend the first 10, 15 minutes talking nothing about iMeme or the products, but really just kind of chatting with these folks about their kids or about their family life. And
he remembered it. The 10Xers would remember this stuff about their kids and family life?
Yes. And he remembered these details.
Okay.
And what I ultimately realized was that they have these superpowers that it's not like every average salesperson can't have them. They just need help to be as effective when it came to relationships. And so the thought with Connected was twofold. One, we wanted to solve for the classic challenge that everyone had managing their contacts, as sort of a Plaxo 2.0, where you can aggregate your contacts, keep them up to date, never have to do data entry because it does it for you. But then second, more importantly, help you be better at managing your relationships by virtue of the fact that it's going to do a lot of this remembering for you. In terms of keeping you and making you a better relationship person.
For people who don't know, Plaxo was Sean Parker's company that just went insanely viral. You'd get emails from people saying, hey, I want to make sure that my contact information for you is up to date. Click here to fill it out. You fill out a form and then it would say, all right, now not only did your friend Sachin get this data updated, do you want to update your address book? Just become an account member, and then you become an account member, and suddenly everyone on your email list would start getting that message asking them to update their contact information, your address book, and went insanely viral. You're saying you kind of learned from that. I'm looking at an early version of your site where you specifically said you can actually get reminded to follow up with someone within a week, a month, or once a quarter or something like that. The thing that stood out for me was, number one, that it was that screenshot was in a bunch of blogs because people did write about it. But number two, Susan Sue is on there. Andrew Chen is on there. How did you know these people? These are, they're not that they're on there. They're like models on the site, you showing your address book and how it could be used. What's your connection to Susan Sue and Andrew Chen?
So actually I'm married to Andrew Chen's sister.
Okay.
And, so when I first moved to the Valley, I actually got to meet Andrew through Ada. And it was kind of an awesome, helpful way to kind of get plugged into the Valley. He's always been a huge supporter of everything Ada and I have worked on. And through Andrew, I actually met Susan Sue and Brian Balfour and kind of a bunch of the other kind of growth-focused people.
Oh, and Andrew Chen has been a guy who's written about viral marketing and had really insightful opinions about tech companies. And now he's a partner at Andreessen Horowitz, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
Do you spend time actually talking to him in private about your work, or does it feel a little too weird?
No, all the time. We love geeking out on tech.
You do.
So we're constantly geeking out about, you know, what he's working on the venture side or our startup and his ideas and growth. And, you know, we're constantly spending time thinking about how do we kind of double down on our growth and NoteJoy. And he's been a huge help for that.
What's a good idea that he's given you?
You know, a lot of it has really just been about how do you bake in virality in the product from day one? You saw it right when you went through the online experience of signing up for NoteJoy. How do you get people to invite from day one? If you'd use G Suite to go through that that onboarding process and even recommend people that you might want to invite. And so we're spending a lot of time reducing the friction of sharing and making sharing as easy as possible, not as like a growth hack, but really as something that's built into the product from day one as a core aspect of the experience.
All right. I got to ask you a personal question. Totally fine, Sandra. This just out of bounds. But with Andrew Chen being your brother-in-law, do you ever feel like your wife is kind of comparing you to Andrew's success? And if you're not meeting it, then maybe she's like not beat with someone who's that successful. Do you feel that way at all? Or is that just me in my head?
No, not actually, not at all. You know, I think one of the things that Aiden and I have really aligned on is, I think success for different people means different things. And I think Aiden and I are really kind of, as I mentioned earlier, on this path to self-actualization. And actually what we've realized is that it's not just about kind of making the most money or having the most success, but doing it in a way that's 100% aligned with your values, such that you're spending your time every day doing what you love, as opposed to...
How do you know what that is?
You know, I think it's been a long journey for me. Obviously, I was lucky enough early in my life to know that software engineering was my passion. But it's really been kind of this iteration of getting to the point of realizing that entrepreneurship is my passion, not just kind of building software, but then even doing it in a specific way, right? Like, we're a super lean team. We bootstrapped. We think that actually gives us freedoms, and we kind of take advantage of those freedoms. And it's been sort of a journey of going through different startups, working at large companies like Microsoft and LinkedIn, and enjoying it, but realizing it wasn't my ultimate dream, to really find that, like, okay, there's a style of startup that Aiden and I want to do that's ultimately going to be something that makes us successful.
And I'm surprised that you're saying no outside capital. And you've said that to me even before we started. I think you said it to our producer. And so it feels like it's really important to you. And I'm surprised because you are so bankable. You are so venture backable because of the people you know, because of the track record you've had. Why are you saying no to venture capital with NoteJoy? And we'll talk about what that is soon, but why?
Yeah, you know, it turns out like we're in this kind of broad-based document collaboration space, and we've seen tons of failures of venture-funded startups in this space. I can name three in the time that we've started.
What are three?
Canvas, Bold, and Memo AI. All three of these companies have raised millions of dollars, and now they're all dead. And it turns out the challenge with the classic venture-funded route is that you end up in sort of this cycle where you raise a seed round of funding of a few million bucks. You're expected in 18 to 24 months to convert that somehow into a million in ARR or more. And then you go and raise subsequent rounds. It turns out when you're in the document collaboration space competing with incumbents like Google Docs and Microsoft Office, the ability to, in 18 to 24 months, to turn any product into a viable alternative, let alone something that's generating a million ARR, is next to impossible. Almost no one's been able to do it. And so you have two choices at that point. You either raise a ton of money, like folks like Coda and Airtable have done, or you cockroach it. You really kind of build a model where you can be a lean team as long as possible till you find product market fit. And then sure, raise. But at a point where you really have kind of the vehicle working, both in terms of users loving the product, but actually the growth engine's turning to working. And so we've decided the cockroach approach, that we'd rather have the freedom to invest in product and innovation till we can get it right, as opposed to putting us on this kind of venture style rat race where you're expected to reach these milestones in these 18 to 24 months, which is very difficult in the market that we're in.
I can see that. All right, let's continue. And then I want to come back to NoteJoy, because I want to ask you, how do I fit this into my life? You, for some reason, just hit huge on Product Hunt. And I said, I got to figure out what it is that I could do with it. And I couldn't find it. All right. So you were running Connected. You got a lot of publicity for it. You got users on. It went viral. And then within like no time, let me see how long it was. Within how long was it before you sold? It was a year?
Less than a year.
Why'd you sell so fast?
Yeah, so we launched February 2011. We had been working on it for about a year and a half, but then we ended up selling it in October 2011. And, you know, it was interesting. We had no plans to sell it at the time. We were continuing to work on the product. And what was exciting about Connected was we had seen a lot of failures in this space of contact management, tools like Zobni and others in the space. And what we decided was to put a price tag on it from day one.
So we $10 a month, I saw.
Yep, $10 a month for the product. And we really wanted to make sure people were actually willing to pay for this thing, as opposed to building something with millions of users and not being able to monetize it like some of my brethren had done. And so we charged from day one. And what was exciting was just even months after we launched, our conversion funnel was quite strong. We were seeing 8 to 12% of people who joined up our homepage sign up for the free trial. Then 6 to 8% of those convert to the full paid product. And so every time I showed this to anyone, you know, it turned out like everyone we talked to, like Andrew and all these guys, were like, your conversion funnel is strong. Your challenge is growth. And so we started spending like 80% of our time on growth. And we did integrations with third-party applications. We tried to get people to write about us. We were seeing a lot of success in the real estate space. So, you know, we were doing a lot of blogging in real estate. And, you know, it was one of these things where all our growth channels were linear. And so we were planning on just keeping on plugging away. And then it turned out LinkedIn had actually been following us from the beginning, when we first launched in February 2011, when we launched, when we announced our seed funding in about July 2011. And they kept seeing the product iterate and improve. And so Elliot Schmuckler was head of the core product team at LinkedIn, called us in and said, "Hey, I'd love to hear more about what you're doing." And what he was saying was that, you know, at LinkedIn, they wanted to kind of double down on the address book scenario. But what they saw in our product was everything they had imagined building, but so much more that they didn't even thought of.
Like and, what?
You know, like we were doing things like, for example, that reminder feature we talked about was not just reminding you to get back in touch on whatever cadence you said, maybe I want to get in touch with someone every month, but it actually looked at the fact, have you communicated with that person? If you've communicated with that person in the last month, we won't bother you with a reminder. If you haven't, that's when we'll remind you. And that was because we had access to your email, your calendar, even your phone calls via Google Voice. So we had your entire conversation history. So we can be super smart about these reminders to make less work for you.
I get it. And I love the product looked so good and it was smart. What it would do is it would, if I added a little bit of contact information, it would go and pull all of the person's social media information in there, not just links to it, but if, tell me if I'm wrong, it would even pull in information about their accounts, yeah. Right? So that if I happen to meet someone who was on Twitter talking about how they just got sick, I could bring that up.
Yeah. Right?
It pulled
and
it in.
Amazing because like what it would do is like it made it super easy where your contact information was updated automatically. So someone simply updated their LinkedIn profile to say they have a new job, contact records updated. Someone updates their location on Facebook to say they moved to a new city, automatically updated, no data entry on your part.
All right. I should say my second sponsor is a company called TopTal for hiring developers. You talked about 10Xers developers. Do you have an example of what a 10Xer, this is part of the ad for TopTal, instead of talking about TopTal, I'll talk about a 10X developer. Do you have an example of what a 10X developer was able to do for you that others couldn't do?
You know, I think it just comes out like, you know, I've always been kind of the primary developer in actually my apps, both Anywhere.fm, Connected, and NoJoy. And what people are always surprised about was just how productive we've been as a team, especially in terms of how much product we've been able to build, both at Connected and NoJoy. And so, you know, hate to toot my own horn, but, you know, it turns out that, you know, when you're able to do it, you can accomplish way more with fewer resources. It's great.
All right. If you're out there and you're looking to hire really the best of the best, if you're looking for cheap, if you're looking for somebody who's just an interesting bargain, this is not for you. Just skip this ad. But if you're looking for the best of the best developers, go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. They will immediately get on a call with you so you can tell them what you're looking for. You'll chat with them and then they'll introduce you to a couple of developers. And often they will be exactly what you're looking for. And if they are, you can get started often within days. If not, nothing lost. I will even say this. Once you start with them, not only will they give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit for free when you pay for your first 80 hours, they're also going to give you a no-risk trial period. Really, you're not happy, you don't pay, but the developer will still get paid. Sachin and every other entrepreneur who's listening and every other CTO who's listening should go check out toptal.com/Mixergy. Top is in top of your head, tal is in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. I'm going to close it out with a sale. Quora is usually pretty junky for me, but I learned a couple of things. Number one, you seem to have preferred calling it Connected HQ, and I keep calling it Connected. I assume the company, the product name was Connected, and you needed ConnectedHQ.com as a domain. That's what it was. But people eventually started calling it Connected HQ.
That's right. Yeah, no, we just needed the domain. We couldn't get the domain. It was an unfortunate name because people started Googling Connected and we could never win the search rankings for Connected. So we started to kind of call it Connected HQ to get people to search for Connected HQ.
That is what I prefer. If your domain is Connected HQ, I'd rather you just call it Connected HQ. It becomes really difficult for me to search and do research and prep for someone. Right. The second thing I would say is, so this someone on Quora asked how much was the acquisition price for Connected HQ. And this woman, Joan Hoffman, went and did the research. She goes in and sees the 10K filing for LinkedIn from 2011. LinkedIn acquired three companies back then for $7.4 million. Then she looked at the three different companies and Card Munch was one of them. That, according to the S1 filings, was for $1.7 million, which leaves $5.7 million for Connected and Index Tank, the other company. According to Crunchbase, Index Tank raised 1.6. Anyway, she basically comes down to the bottom line, which says that Connected would have sold for 1.4 million. Is this crazy?
It's pretty crazy because it turns out when you look at the way these acquisitions are done, the actual, actual compensation goes across both acquisition and actual consideration, that you get as an employee. And so they can play with where it shows up. It leads to, unfortunately, the filing actually not disclosing the full amount of acquisition consideration that comes out of it.
All right. You sold. You stuck with it. Most people would have left within like a year or so. You stuck for the full 4 years. And it wasn't just staying in. Was it 4 years?
Yep.
It was. And it wasn't just staying in there for 4 years. Dude, I got lost in your story of what you did at LinkedIn. You were someone who was like totally into it. They gave you a lot of responsibility. You said from the start, I'm not going in there and changing their culture. I'm going to change my culture to theirs. We're going to fit in here. I'm going to make a difference. And as a result, your software was built into what? And then we'll move on to NoteJoy. What happened with the stuff that you did?
Yeah, so it kind of had two amazing tours of duty at LinkedIn. The first was we took the Connected software, integrated deeply on the LinkedIn stack. And as I mentioned, like, you know, a bunch of the code is still being used to this day. But now anytime you're on LinkedIn, if you go to the contacts tab within LinkedIn where you can manage your connections, that was all of our team. Anytime you get a job change notification, either on the app in an email, that was our team. When you see people mentioned in the news, that was our team. So a lot of these relationship-oriented capabilities on LinkedIn were all about what we were able to build into LinkedIn and really kind of have LinkedIn start to care more about relationship management as opposed to just being kind of the professional profile of record, which it was really the focus at the time.
You were working at LinkedIn when you realized that there was a problem in the way that big teams communicate. You started talking to our producer about how you'd have these all hands meeting with 500 people. Wow, that's a lot of people for you to manage. And what happened there that led you to think about NoteJoy?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I had a second tour of duty at LinkedIn, which was awesome, which was, you know, when we were working on Connected, a lot of our top users paying us for the product were sales professionals, as you'd expect, because they're the people who are in the relationship business. And so I kept telling LinkedIn, hey, you guys should build a tool for salespeople. And while they had a general subscription, they didn't have anything dedicated to sales professionals. So ultimately, they said, hey, do you want to build the product? And I got a chance to build a kind of venture team inside of LinkedIn, build a brand new enterprise scale product dedicated to sales professionals. We ended up launching it called Sales Navigator. And what was awesome about that experience is it went from about 8 engineers in a corner kind of ideating a bunch of ideas. I then got the opportunity to present it at an offsite then got insane funding for it. Within the next 2 years, we ultimately grew the team to about 500 folks. This is 50 people in R&D, 50 people in marketing, and 400 people in direct sales. Ultimately grew the revenue for Sales Navigator to over $200 million in revenue, and now it's grown well past that. And found myself in this situation where I'd gone from kind of a product manager, you know, working with a bunch of engineers to really a GM of a large organization. And it turned out, you know, I wasn't spending any of my time on core product in the way I used to, because I had a whole team of product managers. I was really spending all my time thinking about how do I make this ship of 500 people constantly move in the right direction?
Yeah.
And I really made that my focus. And that's when a lot of the ideas started for NoteJoy, because what we were noticing was that I was spending all my time really focusing on how do I make sure everyone's aligned, moving in the right direction? This would be things like those all hand meetings I was talking about. I'd walk in and lead one of these all hands and realize I'm about to waste 500 person hours. So this better be useful in the sense that there's 500 people who are going to waste an hour with me. So it better be useful. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about that content. we spent a lot of time on things like quarterly OKR processes, which is objectives and key results, a goal setting framework that we were big users of at LinkedIn, and really trying to make sure everyone was moving in the same direction. And yet, when I talked to people, I'd ask them, hey, do you feel like you have everything you need to be successful in your role? And people would constantly tell me, you know, LinkedIn's a big company. I'm sure there's something going on in this organization that I should be benefiting from that I don't know about. And that just made us realize that we were leveraging all these people processes, OKRs, meetings, daily standups, emails, to keep everyone up to date on what was going on. And the tools we were using weren't doing much for us, whether it was email, Slack, Google Docs, in terms of keeping everyone up to date, having everyone have the right information that they need. And we felt like there was this opportunity to solve this gap that was resulting in it being very difficult to find institutional knowledge that was really valuable for you.
So why not just create a wiki? I think memo.ai was a wiki-based product. Why not just pick one of those and say, all the information about how our company works is going to be in this one thing?
You know, it turns out every company's done that. We tried that at LinkedIn as well. We adopted Confluence, which is Jira's wiki solution. And the biggest thing that happens is everyone starts with good intention that, great, we're going to keep this wiki up to date. And then it meets the reality of work life, which is I'm super busy getting my job done. And what we noticed was that people use a wiki when they feel like they need to broadly share content with the team. But when they're just getting stuff done, they're using a different set of tools. And so what we realized, there was a significant friction point between tools like Confluence and whatnot and the day-to-day tools people preferred using just to get work done.
I feel that same thing happens in my company too, that we will say to everyone, if you have something that you're doing or something that you need to remember for the future, just go and put it in a Google Doc or put it in, we use Basecamp. I really like Basecamp simplicity. And we don't do it. We don't create a new thing for it. Where we end up coming back to is, if we're using chat or if we're using messaging or in tasks, you could always go back and search for the tasks and see what was the process. It feels like just saving the process as people do it would be the answer. Why do you think that notes would be the answer to this problem?
You know, it turns out what you've observed is exactly what happens. Everyone falls back on email and Slack instead of Google Docs or wikis. And what you see is that 90% of institutional knowledge within an organization is email, Slack, stuck in people's head, whiteboards, and only 10% makes it to that doc or wiki.
I'd also add to that task. So Asana, Basecamp, whatever you're using.
Yeah. And the challenge though is that people are using email and Slack because it's frictionless to capture and share. But then you don't get any of the value. Like actually, honestly, searching through any of those tools is miserable. Finding anything later that might be relevant is very difficult. New employee joins, like what do you expect them to sit there and kind of scroll through pages of Slack messages? Not going to happen. And so we believe what was happening was you have these low friction tools like email and Slack, and then these high friction tools like Google Docs and wikis. And we felt like there needs to be a middle ground where it's low friction like email and Slack, but then has all of the structure and the searchability of something like a Google Doc and Wiki. And that's where we felt the existing tools were falling short, and we had an opportunity to create something new.
Okay, so then it took you 6 months, I think, to create the first version. Am I right about that?
Yep.
And then you went into alpha?
Yep.
You're working with your wife on this?
Yep.
Like co-founders. And you said, what can we do to make this better than Evernote?
Yeah.
Why Evernote?
You know, like what we noticed actually was that when people are working, they're capturing notes when they're doing the work itself. Maybe it's an Evernote, maybe it's an Apple Notes, maybe it's just an email, draft email that they have open. And when they're doing work, that's where the content is being created in the first place. And then later it migrates into a Google Doc or Wiki. And what we thought was, what if we can create an experience that has all the productivity of that lightweight interface that you're already using to do the work, but then also has all the collaborative features that you expect in a Google Doc and a Wiki. And our idea was to create both a super, super productive experience like Evernote. So it has apps for all the platforms you'd expect. It has keyboard shortcuts, markdown. Speed is a huge feature for us. And a lot of time is spent on making that you super productive in the interface, but then also gives you all the collaborative aspects. And so we thought that Notes was this right kind of model to get people to capture more than they've ever been capturing, because it feels far lighter weight. You open up a Google Doc and you think, you're not going to put three bullet points in it and share it. You would with a note, though. And oftentimes, that's all you need to communicate the information. And so notes felt like the right metaphor and analogy for what we're trying to accomplish.
You want, like, if I'm thinking through what to do next or what we did that worked for the last scotch night so that we remember for the next one, you're thinking, I'm going to hit a button and I'm going to be able to open up a new note. I'm going to save it. And then if it's in our notebook that's shared, then the rest of the team will have it.
Exactly.
And as you looked at Evernote, what did you see that they were missing? Because they do that.
You know, their collaboration features are very light.
So, you know what? I'm sorry to rip into like into interrupt you, but we used to use them for interviews. It was so bad because if my assistant, a minute before the interview, came in and wrote a note while I was preparing for the interview, we'd end up with two different notes.
Exactly, exactly.
That's the worst.
And you know, the challenge is Evernote has not only merged conflicts when you're working with other people, it has merged conflicts when you're working with yourself. If you
right, I would do that on my phone, and then they don't. Exactly. I'm sorry to interrupt. They don't actually update in real time. The lowest you could set it to is 15 minutes. I don't know why they shifted into chat when they didn't solve that one freaking issue.
Exactly.
And so then if I'm on my phone making a note edit, and then I come back to my desktop to make another note edit, I have to remember, no, it didn't sync. I have to hit sync.
Yes.
That's what you're talking about.
To hit sync is insane.
Right.
And that's where we saw a huge opportunity. Technically, yes, you could share a note in Evernote, but the experience fell short as soon as you started to do that. With NoteJoy, it's the complete opposite. When you share notes with other people, we have full real-time collaborative editing experience, just like you're used to in Google Docs. Multiple people can be editing a note across any interface. People can be on web, desktop, mobile. And it's full fidelity. You never lose any information across whatever device you're in. We also kind of went above and beyond with other collaborative features. We have full-on threaded discussions that you can have right within the note.
All right, I've got one of your notes. So this is my second account. The first one was the personal use. Now, because I couldn't remember my password like within the 5 minutes before we started, I just loaded it using my business account. And you're right. The virality part made a lot of sense. As soon as I sign up, you said, hey, do you want to also add everyone else with using the @Mixergy email address, which I love because I need, if we're going to use it, I want it to be all connected. I'm in here. Where would I have a threaded discussion with people on my team about this note? I've got one of the notes open right now.
Yeah. So, well, I think if you skip to the create a team library piece, you have to do that first. And so if you just press the add button, and then it says add team library, make sure you make a library with your team.
Ah, okay. I see it now. Add notebook, add note, or add team library. And so now I can start a conversation with everyone and they automatically get access to all the notes in that fold,
Any note you create in there is immediately shared with that team. And it's sort of like Slack channels where you don't have to worry about sharing permissions on a kind of per email basis. You just put in the right Slack channel. So you might compose a note in your personal notes. You're ready to share it. Just drag it and drop it to the Mixergy team library. And boom, it's automatically shared with all the right people without any sharing permissions on your part.
Okay. And then you said you also, unlike Google Docs, well, we're definitely going over time here. You got a little more time for me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm fascinated by this. Now I logged in I went to your homepage using an incognito window. And now I see it. So on the right side, I would actually get to see who's in there, right of my notes. And I would get to see the chat that's happening around this. All right. My next thought then is, all right, I get why it's better than Evernote. Cause I just don't like Evernote. Unfortunately, like you said, Markdown, I heard them do a podcast years ago. Someone said, can you please do Markdown? It's easier than this like heavy duty HTML. And they explained why they couldn't do it. It's basically a legacy issue and it's hard for them to go backwards. The thing that you told our producer that stuck out for me was integrations. Like what's the Trello integration? How does that work?
Yeah. So, you know, integrations have been huge for us. I think when you see people in the space, there's one of two mentalities. One is we're going to build everything ourselves, or, you know, we're going to be a best of breed tool and integrate with other best of breed tools. We've taken that approach. You know, in NoteJoy, you can definitely create tasks, but we decided to actually integrate with great tools like Trello. And so that's been super successful for us. So when you're in Trello and you're creating Trello cards, which are actual tasks, now what you can do is embed a NoteJoy note directly into that Trello card. And so the use case is people use Trello for all sorts of things. Maybe you're using it for a content actual library and you're marketing a bunch of content pieces and you have tasks that say you're going to publish this piece next week. behind that task is a blog post that you're meaning to write. And so within NoteJoy, you can actually compose the content in there. But now within Trello, you can view the note without ever leaving Trello and edit the note in the Trello interface without ever leaving Trello.
Even on their mobile app?
Not on mobile, because they haven't actually enabled the Trello power-ups on mobile. But it does work on the Trello desktop app as well as the Trello web app.
Okay, got it. All right. And so that's what you're trying to think of. And you're saying, look, let's suppose Andrew's using Trello for task management. Let's make it easy for the stuff that he writes about these tasks to get saved forever for his team to see. That's the type of thinking you're thinking.
Exactly. Because it turns out when you look at Trello, you can use their little comment field, but you don't get rich text editing. You don't get anything. With us, you get a full rich text editor. You can make those notes available to everyone. But then when someone is implementing that task, they have it accessible right to them.
I do find that with Trello, the reason we had to stop using them, there's no good chat built in, and there's no good notes or no good messaging, I guess you call it. I forget what it is. I like that Basecamp has it all integrated, and I like that we can have this big doc explaining how things work. And so you're saying this is how we're going to work with Trello to give you that.
Exactly. And Trello's been loving it, but they've actually been featuring it for months as one of their feature power-ups because it does solve that gap.
Your issue now is growth. I get how you get me in there. How do you get the rest of the team in there? How do you get, or how do you go beyond my team to grow even more?
Yeah. And so like we're spending a lot of time on kind of overall growth. The one nice thing is that because it's a collaborative app by nature, you know, you obviously do want to invite your colleagues and friends into it to be able to use it. We're actually seeing 30% of our signups come from pure one-on-one invites. And actually, when you add word of mouth, we're about 50% of our signups are coming between virality and word of mouth. But we still want to constantly grow it. What we find is within the organization, if you start using it and actually create content that other people want to view, then you're sort of incented yourself to share it with other people in your team to bring them on. Our real struggle is how do we get new teams that have never heard of NoteJoy to adopt NoteJoy in the first place? And so we've been spending a lot of time on that. And actually, the integration strategy has been great for us. We've integrated with everything from Google Drive to Microsoft Office to Gmail coming soon and Trello. And these integrations have been super helpful for us to really expose us to those audiences.
Because what happens is someone who's on Trello says, I need some kind of better note-taking, better or whatever, rich text formatting. And they discover you and then they go and they create an account with you.
Exactly.
All right. I get that. Yeah. I do feel like the big thing is if you could get me to publish my stuff online using NoteJoy, then everything that I publish would then bring people back into NoteJoy to figure out.
Like, yeah, definitely. We're actually planning on going in that direction and giving you some even better publishing capabilities for super lightweight publishing. Because today, you know, you have WordPress, Medium, but they're still fairly heavyweight and you really got to commit to kind of having a publication. We want to create super lightweight ways to share absolutely anything.
Anything. Like if I have a quick screenshot, I want to share publicly. I need some URL to give people and you do that. I'm dying to switch away from Evernote. I feel like the product just hasn't been updated in a long time. Lots of issues with it for me. If the thing that I'm challenged by is, will the company survive? And so I really like your approach. Yes, we will survive. So your notes will be okay and they'll be safe. The other thing then is tags from Evernote are a problem to move over. And then the third thing is PDFs. So some of my notes will have three different PDFs in them, and it's hard to spot those in different software. Do you have anything? So, you don't do tags, and what do you do about PDFs?
So we're actually seeing that tons of people want to start using NoteJoy as an Evernote alternative. So we're really trying to solve for that use case. We actually do support tags now in NoteJoy. You can just add a hashtag to either the title or a body of a note.
If I move my hashtags. If I move my files over, you will turn all of those tags into hashtags?
We're planning on in our Evernote importer. We haven't launched it yet, but it's coming out shortly. And it automatically will pull on all your existing tags into hashtags within NoteJoy. So you can use them as tags.
And then if I start creating a new tag using a hashtag, will you try to pre-populate? Right. Good. Is that one of the problems with creating hashtags is you think that the note could be interview, but you actually last time wrote interviews. And then the time before that, you actually called the tag int, meaning it's interview. And then every time you create a new tag, you don't remember. And so that's a problem. Okay.
Yep. And then on the PDFs thing, we actually let you upload any kind of rich document, PDF, Word files, images.
But that's as a separate doc. Can I actually have, if I import, do you think I'll be able to have a doc that has three different PDFs?
Yes.
All work in there? I will.
Yeah. So with NoteJoy, actually, you have the note and it can be a container of any number of docs. So you can upload three PDFs into one note and it's all contained within the note. And then the great thing is we just launched Search Inside Images and Documents. So if you then search for text that's in the PDF,
right,
or even an image, we actually do OCR on it, you can now find those things just as quickly as you'd expect to get back to that content.
I see you do password protecting of notes. I don't know why I care that much about notes. I do, though. I care about it a lot. I think it's because I write stuff and then I can't freaking find it. I write it and so I do my best. I tag it. I put it in the right folder and I still can't come up with it unless I use, and that's where Evernote is still okay. It's easy to get stuff in there. It sucks to search, but at least you could search.
Yeah, that's right. And so like, I think search has been a huge focus area for us. And, you know, we actually even just introduced a solo plan, even though we've been largely focused on team
collaboration. See, $4 a month.
Yeah, just $4 a month because we have tons of interest in folks getting off of Evernote, not knowing their future.
Yeah, they really dropped the ball. They had an opportunity. This was going to be a company for 100 years. And then it was, you know what? We want to do this other thing instead. We see that you guys have security issues. We'll figure it out. We promise.
Yeah.
And then they didn't. That's too bad. That's too bad. So you're basically setting up here to be in this business for the next 10 years at least.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it's one of these things people always ask me, you know, you've been a serial entrepreneur, you know, what's next? And I'm like, I've only been a serial entrepreneur is because I've never been able to find the company that I could do for the rest of my life. My aspiration is to be the next Bill Gates, not to be a serial entrepreneur.
I do find that the people who I most admire, who build businesses that last, are in there forever. And they're fine with that. They want that.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone else wants to just be in and out. And for some reason, that's not me. And it's not the people I admire.
Yeah. I do hope NoteJoy becomes my forever company and we're operating like it will be.
All right. For anyone who wants to go check it out, I'm going to send them over to Product Hunt. Go see how much people freaking love this new app on Product Hunt. But I think the better way to do it is to go to NoteJoy. There's not like NoteJoyApp.com, NoteJoyHQ.com. It's just NoteJoy. And it's super easy to type. Even my bad spelling can always get onto it. All right. Congratulations on this company.
Thank you.
And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first will get you publicity for your business called justreachout.io/Mixergy. And the second will help you find those 10 extra developers. It's called toptal.com/Mixergy. I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. And I'll also say to anyone who hasn't tried Mixergy on one of your special speakers, which speaker do you use? Alexa? Do you use
Alexa?
Use Alexa. Me too, because you can put it all over the freaking house. Shout at it next time. Alex, whatever. Play Mixergy and see if it works for you because it's so fun to listen to podcasts on that device. Thanks so much, Sachin.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.